sails Caiaphas, or is it Jason Horsley, or Jason Caiaphas or Aeolus Horsley? One or all or none of the above. And this is the first episode of the new season of Warps and Storms, more theories about the weather, where the big picture meets the small picture. This podcast is part of the Stormy Weather Existential Detective Agency, which is an online group forum for pattern recognition and identity deconstruction. What you're about to hear are four conversations taken from the inner workings of Sweater, the interactions of the group, which are generally private. These have been selected for public airing to give those interested an idea of just what is going on inside the Stormy Weather Existential Detective Agency. The first conversation is between Mark and myself. It's on letting infinity take care of itself. And the second is between Zach and I on the patterns of the mind, how the mind is constructed by consciousness as a defense system. Then there's a chat between Gabe and I on what it means to hold a space for our women. And finally, there's a short chat between Gabe and Mark on just what it is like being a Sweater, what it entails. That's all for now. This is Sailor Horsley, and this is Warts and Storms. Think you've had enough? Stop talking. Help us get ready. Think you've had enough? Big business after the shake-up. Think you've had enough? Stop talking. Help us get ready. The thing about knowing is that little by little it's take over your life, because the more you recognize what you know and just experience it and live from what you know, the more you know that that's the only way to live. Because anything else that you don't know just doesn't mean anything. It's got no value. It's a belief, it's an opinion, it's a hope, it's a fear. Whatever it is, you don't know it. So it's just a thought form. So then, but then what happens is that you begin to see that the only thing to live for is what you know. And so then a knowing starts to come into being, which is that there's nothing in it for you. In this life, you're not going to get anything out of it except the joy and the peace of staying in what you know, which isn't an it anyway. It's not something you get. It's just there that it's what makes it possible. If there wasn't well-being in knowing, then none of us could possibly make it. But a knowing is. Because it's so fine, it's such a small part of you, it's very hard to stay in it. So then when you come out of that knowing, all you've got is kind of this sense eating away at you that there's nothing in it for you, that this life is not for you. And so then it's like your ego, your identity says, well, then it's meaningless. There's no reason to live. And then that can become like an anti-knowing, you know, that can pick up its own momentum, and the thoughts and fears just get so hooked into this and energize it, this pattern of defiance, really. Well, if this life isn't for me, then fuck it. Yeah. Then I might as well just self-destruct. So, you know, where I might compare to you is my knowing is, well, perhaps it's not that my knowing's bigger, it's that I'm smaller and I've reduced myself and gone into a finer knowing, but whatever, however it is, the fact is that I do know through and through that this life isn't for me, and I'm living that way to a much greater extent than you are. But that doesn't mean that I don't have this anti-knowing and still eating away at me from time to time. And although it doesn't come out in compulsive self-destructive behavior, it does make it very hard to get up in the morning. It does make it very hard to eat. Like, I actually don't want to feed my body, because why? What's in it for me, you know? So that's, you know, as you keep going finer, then
you get closer to the truth of reality, which is that all you need to do is take care of your physical, the physical reality, what you know, like your health, your cleanliness, your clothing, your finances, those that are entrusted to your care, and then the people, you know, around you, you know, your interactions, and just your physical reality, starting with your body. That's all you have to take care of, and the more energy and focus you put into that, the more it'll clear up all of this crap, because you just won't have time to think about that, and you'll just know more and more that it's not relevant. It's not your business.
Yeah. That sounds about right. Right now my apartment is like a complete mess, but I need to, I don't think I've taken a shower in the last couple of days, but.
Well, that's, yeah, that's the insistence. That's the thin end of the wedge of suicide, which is the ultimate insistence, which just stops taking care of yourself and the things around you.
Yeah.
You know, because of the despair. So then, actually tackling those things, maybe tackling isn't the word, but addressing.
Yeah.
Like being in your apartment in the mess it is, and actually just being in the mess, really being all the way in it. And without talking to yourself too much about, like, well, I could be, you know, homeless in the streets of Vancouver, or I could be living in Biafra, starving to death. Nonetheless, there's a knowing that actually this is your home, and that this is a good place for you to be. This is like, there really is a lot to appreciate about your home, even when it's a total tip.
Yeah.
All you have to do is tune into that, and there's that feeling of being at home. That's why you come home and you take off your shoes and you feel, ah, I'm home, right? That feeling that you get.
Yeah.
But then there's this saying, yeah, but my home's a tip, so you're not quite at home as you would be because it's such a tip, and that mess is reminding you of how fucked up you are, and so on. So then, but let go of all that stuff, because you know that it doesn't, it's not really relevant. You know, you just are as fucked up as you are, and you've chosen not to tidy up your flat, and you're okay with it, really. Otherwise, you would tidy it up. So then be okay with being in a messy flat. Be in the enjoyment of being at home. And then maybe from there, you're going to think, well, actually, I really love my home. Why don't I tidy it up?
Yeah, for sure.
Like a good woman, you want to treat her right. Or an animal, or a child, you take care of it. It's an extension of you, and what you give to it is what you'll then surround yourself by.
Definitely, for sure, man.
And so then, if you extend that to the body, like you as consciousness living in your body, and all the clutter, and the mess, and the dirt that's accumulated in your body.
Yeah.
Because you as consciousness don't feel at home in your body. It's not that you don't feel at home because of all the distortion, it's that the distortion has come from that first not okayness of as you as consciousness as not being at home in your body. And then so then you've tried not to be in your body, and then that's allowed all this stuff to build up, and that's pushed you further and further out of your body. So that's why I was about the astral projection and all this. This is like you, your person, trying to get something that's going to make you feel better about your physical situation.
Yeah.
And it's actually, you're just increasing the divide in between you as consciousness and your physical anchor in this reality. And then that leads to, you know, death, eventually. It's just too great a split. And there's no way to get back to this reality, and that's why you incarnated in the first place, was to be here, not to be off in those realms. See, those realms are, they're always there, and you are always in those realms. That's where you come from, I mean, beyond the astral, and all the way, you know, the infinite source of consciousness that you are, came here to experience the physical and the limitations of identity and selfness. So then you don't have to worry about trying to get to those parts, because you're already there. It's actually navigating this very narrow confined space of your body and your immediate environment. That's where your challenge is.
Yeah, I see.
It's not as much fun, it's not as glamorous, that's for sure, and you don't get to be the one, whatever, you know, a somebody, super cosmic being. But you couldn't stand the weight of that anyway if you did.
Have you seen The One with Jet Li?
Yeah, I started watching it, but I couldn't make it through.
I like that movie.
There's multiples, right?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a whole bunch of different him and different universes. He has to, but one of his self is like traveling through all the universes, killing all the other ones.
Right.
So there's only two left, and they're really, really powerful, like fighting each other.
Well, as you as consciousness, that's how big the picture really is. Like, you're all spread out over the whole multiverse. Yeah. And there's really no hurry getting to the perspective of infinity, because that's what lives inside eternity. Right now you're in the temporal. So the infinite doesn't fit in the temporal, for obvious reasons. It only fits inside eternity. So then, yeah, I mean, you've had a taste of the infinite, as have I, and it's pretty deranging. It can fuck a guy up for a long, long time.
Yeah.
But the crazy part is that we want to get back to it. It's fucked us up so much that we feel like we can't just function in the here and now, so then we just think, well, go back to the infinite, even though it was fucking so terrifying, it just reduced me to dust. Somehow we still want to actually go back there.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling.
But, I mean, this thing about infinite is it's everywhere, so. And that's what Sweater is for, is to go finer, to go deeper. Instead of going outward and upward and trying to make everything big, you drop. And the more you drop into the fine, into the subtle, into the detail, then the more space that frees up for this, for the infinite, to actually start moving through your life.
Yeah.
And the infinite will take care of everything, you know that. Yeah. Do you see your mind as an obstacle? An obstacle?
Sometimes. Mostly.
So what's it an obstacle to?
I guess it's an obstacle between my body and my point of view. It seems to always be interrupting or taking my attention away or causing me to ignore my body and be tense.
Mm-hmm. Because you find yourself identifying with your thoughts.
Identifying with my brain?
With your thoughts.
Oh, yes.
Like you follow them.
Yes.
So then you're experiencing your mind as something out of your control.
Usually. Sometimes not, but usually.
Mm-hmm. So then, it's like you feel like your mind is taking you out of what you know?
Yes.
And you want to get back into what you know?
Yes.
Well, identifying with the mind is a habit. It's identifying with our thoughts that enable our thoughts to possess us. So then, the tendency to try and counteract that is to then disidentify with our thoughts and disown them and say, that's not me. And then our thoughts, our mind becomes an obstacle or an adversary. Mm-hmm. But then that's sort of like trying, like what we do with our father, for example. If he's not a good role model, then we turn him into a negative role model and we define ourselves against that and do everything differently from our father, but it's still a reaction against him, so we're still actually letting ourselves be defined by our father. Mm-hmm. Even though we're trying to do the opposite, because we're trying to do the opposite, we're still, the frame of reference is the same. So then the antidote to over-identifying with the mind isn't to disown the mind, to perceive it as something that's foreign or something that's antithetical to who you are. Because the mind, I mean, when you talk about your point of view, what is that? What is this point of view that is preventing from experiencing your body because of your mind?
Could be part of my mind stopping the other part of my mind.
But what is this point of view? I mean, how do you experience that? Or what would be another word to describe it?
For example, if I have really good relationship with or not really good, but if I think I have a really good relationship with an idea, and then I keep going on with this idea and learning, and eventually I might learn something that makes me see the idea in a whole new light, and I feel like the point of view or another way to get at that is like the part that would be kind of wrapped up in the moment of being like, oh, this idea, I really like it, and I'm going to follow it. And then once you learn more and you get the new light going with the idea, then you're like, oh, I feel tricked by this idea.
By the idea or by your mind? I mean, is the idea some autonomous entity that can trick you? How's that work?
It feels like it, but I don't think so.
So then you're talking about parts of yourself?
Yeah.
Like a kind of fragmentation?
Yeah.
Because the mind, as you know it, as you experience it now, comes into being relatively late in our development. I mean, it takes a few years anyway before the internal dialogue is fully installed as an interpretation system which is inseparable from its function also as a defense system. Because when experience, direct bodily experience, is too much for us, then we come out of it by interpreting it, by analyzing it. So I think that we learn to analyze and interpret via the mind very early on as a defense reaction. And so then that becomes like a default setting for our mind. That's essentially what it does. It kicks in defensively before anything else. So then the mind's already running the whole time because it's always ready to defend and protect. It's always in place. And so then it's always interpreting even when it doesn't need to interpret anything. So like with an idea, for example, if an idea comes, where do ideas come from? Well, we don't know, but let's say from the unconscious, just to simplify it. And if an idea wells up from your unconscious, there's a period before which we get a hold of that idea with our minds and begin to interpret it and flatten it out, analyze it and figure out how we can use it, in which that emerging idea may be just a color or a shape or a tune or a bodily vibration. It's a current, let's say. It's a current of consciousness, a ripple, like coming up from below the surface, coming up to the surface. So then, as soon as you get a hold of that idea and that ripple, you want to follow it and you want to direct it also. Because there's a defense system in place, you're not happy just to follow the idea and see where it came from or where it's going, or both, because that might take you areas that you don't want to go. Areas that your defense system was set up to protect you from. So then you actually try and direct it. So then it's not just a ripple, it's a, you know, you're adding your own intent to that ripple. And so then it's no longer a pure ripple. So that's sort of what the mind is then. It's this construct of directed attention, of interpretations, beliefs, all these mechanisms that have been set in place as a means for consciousness to deal with its environment. But, I mean, the distortion has already begun. It's like you as consciousness, which is when you say that's the point of view, and then there's the body. That to me is you experiencing yourself as consciousness, consciousness that dwells within a body. So then when you say my body, although you may not be in a place of knowing about this, you are attempting to speak for yourself as consciousness rather than your mind or your identity, right? Because your mind doesn't have a body. Your body doesn't belong to your constructed identity, because the body was here before the constructed identity. What was here before your body would be consciousness. So that point of view, that's consciousness, that's you as consciousness, came into being like a seed, and a body formed around it, and or of it, however that happened. And then that was your first identity as this person that you are, that your physical being. Even as a fetus, that was a kind of identity, even though there wasn't self-awareness. And then as you're born, then you really are a separate being, so that there's an identity that others can see and recognize, and little by little you learn to recognize and identify yourself as an identity through mirroring what people see, what people are reflecting back at you. Because of a lot of that's hostile and distorted and fucked up because of the environment that you're born into, of all these people who are not okay, all this not okay energy, you had to match that. You can only match what you see. So then you form an identity matching all this not okay energy. you distort yourself as consciousness in order to fit, right? And in order to secure a safe place within that and to get what you want and need for your well-being, starting with mother's attention and the breast and food and warmth, all those things, like, as you experience like the not okayness of not having these things, then you distort yourself to get them, and your mind comes into being as a reflection of that distortion, because you're creating it from that distorted place in order to try and protect yourself and get what you want as consciousness. So then what I'm getting to here is that the mind, as you experience it now, is a true reflection of your own distortion as consciousness.
So when you say the mind, do you mean the behaviors of the mind?
Right, all the patterns.
All its habits and patterns.
The mechanisms that you can't control or direct or override, so then you're perceiving them as an obstacle because you have a sense of yourself as consciousness and how you're limited by that construct that you call the mind. But what you're not seeing is that construct you call the mind was created by you as consciousness from a place of already being distorted. So then it's not the mind that's responsible for your distortion, it's the reverse.
It was the defense.
It's the distortion that created the mind. So then the reason all of this is worth knowing is because what it tells you is that your mind is a true reflection. And therefore there's nothing that needs to be fixed or changed about it, or overridden. Even if you could do that, which you can't, because it's fixed. It's what makes it so restricting. It's what makes a pattern, is that it can't be changed. But if you turn it around and see that it's reflecting something within you that is a deeper distortion, and that that isn't fixed, that is mutable, that is changeable, that is, it's like a water in a glove, really. Like you as consciousness gets poured into this glove you call the mind, and so then you as consciousness takes the shape of that glove, the mind. So then you experience the restriction of it. And then you want to change the shape of the glove when all you have to do is just flow somewhere else. And let the mind, let the glove just be there. But before you can do that, you need to see the ways in which you've allowed your mind to define you as consciousness. And see the shape that you're in as consciousness, like by looking at your mind. So then it's like, rather than seeing your mind as something to change or fix, it's like a map. You can just read it. You're not going to get angry with a map because it's, you know, there's mountains over there and there's no road over there. It's just a map. You know, as long as it's true to the territory, then you can use it.
Is it true to the territory? Always?
Yeah, it has to be. You know, because, you're a creation, the you that you're accustomed to, which is the false you, is a creation of your environment, and your environment is true. It's a reality. You've created a distortion in order to deal with your reality, but the reality that you were trying to deal with was real. So then, that's what makes it a map. You see, it's like somebody who has to struggle over all this terrain, but he takes notes when he does it. So, however painful it was, making that map, it's still true to the experience. The mistake that we make is that we get so identified with the struggle of making the map, we don't ever want to go on that territory again, so then we convince ourselves that the map is the territory. And we can just sit and look at the map, and we don't ever have to go back there, which defeats the object of why we made the map. And of course it limits us to just staring at a map the whole time. So then, I mean, it's like you want to get straight to the territory now without looking at the map, kind of thing, because I think you came to Sweater drawn by whatever you heard of myself and wanted... a way to get free of something. Whereas Sweller it's not about looking inward, it's about looking outward and then using what we see outside of us to understand what's within us, you know, our makeup. If we just go inward and look, it's not possible because the mind can't analyze the mind any more than the government can investigate itself.
Yeah.
We're not trustworthy, that's the point. But if we look outward at the terrain, then we can actually see our distortions in a clear way. It's difficult because we have to decode the information. It's not like billboards spelling it out for us, but it's there. I mean, have you been keeping up on the recent posts now? Are you at that stage?
Yes.
So like the little dialogue I had with Jeremy recently, did you read that about the butterfly and the cockroach?
Yes.
And did you get a sense from that of what I'm talking about now?
I think so, as I need to listen to this conversation again.
Yeah, that was weird.
It went down.
I got a virus attacked my Skype. I think it was because somebody, you know, tried to join my contacts, but it wasn't anybody. I think it was probably a pawn, you know. You know, you occasionally get those pawn people trying to Skype you. Do you ever get that?
Yeah, I got one the other day. Becky or whatever, I don't know.
The cyber whores.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think she gave me a cybernetically transmitted disease.
Penicillin, cyber penicillin.
Yeah, no, I'm going to have to take care of it, true, but not right now. So... were there others of your questions you wanted to look at?
I was going to talk to you about like holding a space for your partner. Because lately, the other day, Andrea was like, "You've been so nice lately." And I said something like, "Yeah, I'm just trying to hold a space for us." So...
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, "Where did you hear that?" And I said, "I said I heard it from, Satan/Jesus." That's all I said.
Well, that really clears things up for her.
She laughed and stuff, but maybe it's because I'm at the last chapter of Homer Serpian.
Yeah, right.
Lucifer Coyle. That's what that was on my mind, I guess. But, and I just wanted you to just go into more detail about if you could, about holding a space open. So.
Well, I first heard the phrase from Michelle, who got it from John. And Michelle described what John said as that it's the man's job to hold the space and it's the woman's job to fill that space with love. So this kind of most superficial analogy of that would be a man who does the work and whatever's necessary, conquers the terrain, even finds the plot of land to, and builds the house, and then the woman creates the nest within that. In terms of innermost and outermost, masculine, feminine, and yin and yang, it's like in an alchemical couple, what happens is it recreates externally what's occurring within ourselves constantly, or wants to be occurring, which is that if we hold the space by clearing out all the clutter, you know, of our psyches, we create a space and hold that space, a space of like our surface self, I suppose it would be, like the way that we are in the world, the way of being that is clean and is upright, then that creates a space for our innermost to move into. And then that innermost, actually, that space belongs to the innermost. So then with a couple, a woman is, because she has a womb, she's connected directly to the source of life. She has a direct line to silent knowledge, to knowing, to the divine. That we don't have. You know, we're our awareness, particularly as wounded, lame men, is in the head, not even in the heart, you know. So, but because a woman is tuned in that way, she, her natural state and her power is that of unfocused awareness. It's not to be a doer, it's a state of being.
Mm-hmm.
Be. But a woman can only really be that if a man holds a space for her. Otherwise she's got to create and hold the space for herself just in order to be safe. Yeah. And that, so that's what happens, you know, in our world and relationship, is that well, the other thing about that's key, because we don't have much time, about what holding a space for a woman means is that, or what it's to do with, is that because of this, women, their consciousness is in their wombs, this is related to how irrational women are. You know, a woman's irrationality and her power and her sexuality, those three things are kind of inseparable. And so, like, for a man to hold a space for a woman means actually being able to contain all of that power, all of that irrationality, all of that sexuality, contain it, no matter how wild and unruly it gets.
Mm.
And if a man doesn't hold that space for the woman, again, she has to do it herself. She has to contain herself. And so then all her energy goes into self-containment. And then that irrationality comes out in all of these distorted ways, because she's not having a man to hold the space. She's having to do it all herself. There's anger, there's resentment. She's not able to express her being, her sexuality. She's not able to tune in to become aware of her power without a man to hold the space for her. So then her power and her sexuality comes out in these really distorted, irrational ways. Often is not directed against the man in question. And hence, you know, personal love leads to violence, becomes a battleground. Because a man who can't contain a woman, hold a space for that unruly feminine, is terrified then of that, of his own inadequacy, and tries to compensate by dominating, by brutalizing, you know, or just by becoming indifferent, you know, cold, hardening and closing and avoiding intimacy. So then what you're doing now, what you're beginning to do now, is again starting with yourself and what you know, rather than trying to fix the relationship with Andrea, just stay in what you know about her and yourself, a little bit that you know, and from that place, little doings, little gestures, little adjustments, slowly creating a space. And then she's getting curious. She's like, what's that over there? Gabe's different. There's, like, she's feeling like a pull towards that space that you're creating. At which point, it's already started to happen from what you said. Then what you get to do and what you get to look out for is you're going to want to go into that space, because you're going to see that she's coming towards it, and you're going to think, oh, I'm going to hop in there so that when she comes in, I can grab her.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be there waiting for her. But it's not for you, it's for her.
Right.
When she's in it, when she comes all the way into the space, then you go into the space. Because then she'll be waiting for you there. But not beforehand.
I'm glad you told me that right now, because, yeah, I didn't. I was like, what comes next? And the heads up.
Yeah, no, nothing comes next, because it's the hardest thing. God knows I'm wrestling with it, Gabe, because waiting for a woman, it feels like it could take a lifetime. And maybe it could, but it's none of our business really, because what makes a space clean, what creates that space at all, is our ability or our willingness to be neutral. To be self-contained ourselves. Not to be trying to get something from the partner. That's what, basically, in a nutshell, that's what holding a space is. You're not trying to get anything from her. So then if you try and create the space so that you can get what you want from her, it's not going to work. Because as soon as the space starts to go, you're going to start trying to push her into it or pull her into it. And then the space disappears. She senses, okay, it's not a real space, it's just an imitation of a space. Like you know, being nice and doing nice things to your woman so that she'll have sex with you, you know. So she'll get in a good mood and then you'll get what you want.
Yeah.
It works for a little while, but it's just enmeshment. Sustaining, you know, the secret agreement. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You know, I'll give you space if you give me togetherness, or vice versa. So yeah, there isn't any way to fake it, but there isn't any need to either, because holding space for a woman and becoming upright, they're two sides of the same coin. Like, as you become more honest with yourself and see your lack of straightness, that makes you more straight, and then that allows you to be neutral with your woman, because, for one thing, you're so busy looking at your own stuff, you've got so much to attend to in your own garden, so much weeding, that you're not going to be focusing that much on her. But more to the point, I think that as you begin to develop a sense of selfness, of your own self, you're going to be looking less and less for some sort of confirmation or validation from the other. Like, you know, if you can, if your woman thinks you're great and thinks you're a real man and thinks you're a hero and thinks you're beautiful and she loves you and reminds you every day, you get to feel upright even if you're not. So a good woman is one who never does that, who never tries to make you feel good or lies to you, you know, to encourage you or build you up. Believe me, I've got myself a good woman and it's living hell for my person, because I don't get anything from it. I don't get a scrap, except for those moments where there's just a tender movement of being, and she recognizes some uprightness in me, and she lovingly acknowledges it, and those moments are what count. So the less you're looking for those moments, the more okay you'll be with there not being any, and the more space you create for them actually just to occur of their own accord when you're not looking for them.
You can do a whole podcast about that alchemical marriage.
Yeah, well, funny enough, Michelle and I'd suggested it to Michelle a couple of months ago that we do it together. But things have sort of taken a turn in the opposite direction lately, so it doesn't seem that likely anytime soon, but I do think it's a good idea, yeah. Or chemical guidance for couples. It's where it's at.
Yeah. That's what everyone, those friends I was talking about, that's always one of the main topics, always. Oh, my girlfriend did this, or my wife did this. Or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the crucible, which is the place that we get to experience all of our distortions. You know, nothing brings that to the fore better than having somebody see us all the time about whom we really care, what they think and what they see. So we're constantly aware of the ways that we're trying to hide stuff, and perception management, and the ways that we're not getting away with it, constant feeling of being exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick is, it's not a trick either, learning not to take it personally, any of it. If you can learn that with your other, your partner, that when she looks at you with contempt, you feel like she hates you, you don't have to take that personally. Man, you're free as a bird at that point. Because that's like the Gorgon's gaze, you know, that'll turn any warrior to stone if he's still invested in his person. When the woman that he loves turns that gaze on him, he's history, man, because that's the original wound, you know, when our mother turned at us with contempt and became this hideous Gorgon. That had such an impact on our psyches. But that, you know, that's the secret of how not to take it personally when we experience it as men, is like, well, okay, well, this is what's making me feel like I could die or kill right now. It's not anything that's happening now. It's not anything that she's doing. It's something that happened way back then. And this need to be with a partner and this fear of losing a partner and being abandoned, well, that is in the past too. Because we don't actually need a woman. We don't need anything. So that's, yeah, I mean, that's also the beautiful paradox of holding a space is like to be able to be with your woman without wanting or needing her, and yet always being actually there, present in a way that when she does come to you, then you're there. You're mm-hmm. absolutely there like that, you know.
Right.
You don't have all this baggage of that she said this and she said that, and just let that go. As soon as it happens, you just keep letting it go and letting it go, and so then you're always there no matter what. But it doesn't matter whether she wants you to be there or not, or whether she needs you to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't matter to you personally. So then you're not really always there, because obviously you're off doing stuff. That's the point. You're upright and independent, but when she needs you, you will be there because you're in tune. That's a binary system. That's an alchemical marriage. It's actually two consciousnesses that begin to move together as one. Scariest thing there is. I guess that's why we're so driven to try and get into that, even though we know it's going to be hell, because it's that pattern of wanting to get back re-enmeshed with our mothers, to go back to the womb. There's a knowing that there is a higher octave of that, which is the alchemical marriage, where we do tune into the womb of our partner in some way and allow ourselves to be submerged in that feminine energy. And reborn through it. But it's a bloody, messy, violent and painful birth, based on my experience anyway.
Think about sex all the time, and then I start to think like it's fucked up doing that, but now I'm starting to, I want to be okay with thinking about sex all the time. Own it. It's been in denial about a lot of things for so long.
I just feel like I just fucked my life up so bad, you know, it's like, I don't know what to do. I like to just like, fucking run away to some other country and fucking just have my way with whatever I want, you know? But that would be just like, it would end up disastrous, you know? I'd end up killing myself and wouldn't get to see my daughter, you know, shit like that. So, whatever.
Because it's like, eventually, even if you run away to the other ends of the earth, you'll have to face that thing you were trying to hide, right? Like, yeah. That's what I feel. Like, cause I felt like running away. I think about that a lot. Like just going somewhere and just leaving. You know?
Yeah. And then I also feel like, well, why do I have to be the one that fucking has to fucking expose myself? You know what I'm saying? Like, how fucking probably there's plenty of other people that I probably personally know maybe have, you know, some kind of shit and they're not saying nothing about it, you know? That's just me putting more shit, you know, just me like avoiding it more, I guess. And Sweater, you know, is just like completely fucking just like made me see so much shit that, you know, there's nowhere to turn now. There's no way to turn away from my distortions, you know, they're always just like right in front of me. And I can still lie to people and act like I'm, or like show myself off as something different. But it's just, now it's just always just so clear that I'm just being a fuck up when I do shit like that, you know?
It's on you. So. It's on me. It's on each one of us. We put ourselves in the situations we're in. It's hard to think about that, but that's the truth of the matter. And our lives are all fucked up. Maybe because that's what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be fucked up so that when now we have all this stuff we can use, all this fucked upness to change into something else.
Yeah. I always think about, like, a tree, you know? A tree just grows, you know, it doesn't need any. It'll grow into, like, a beautiful tree, and doesn't need any help from anything, and things will get in its way, and it'll grow around it, you know? And, I guess that's how I see, you know, our lives, you know, my life as well, you know, I'm gonna flourish, you know, but it's just like, I don't know where I was going with that.
It's just like, you're gonna flourish regardless, but it's like, where's your awareness gonna be while you're flourishing?
Yeah. Well, since I've been a Sweater, you know, now my awareness is a lot, I don't know, it seems like I feel a lot more, I don't know, just like, able to see my fucked upness, you know, and then, and I, what that does is makes me want to fucking express it, you know?
Okay, that's all for this first episode of Warts and Storms, more theorems about the weather. Those who are interested in joining the Sweater can go to aoskafus.com and click on the link on the star that will take you to the Stormy Weather Existential Detective Agency. That's $100 a month. You can come in just for 1 month just to find out what it's like. A month can sometimes be enough to change your life irrevocably. It has been known to happen. Generally, I would say that 3 to 6 months is the requisite time to really get the full Sweater experience. That's all for now. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back next week.